Taiwan Special, Episode 1. No, I'm not going to tell you what's been going on here with the virus over here in Taiwan today. I'm going to save that for tomorrow. Because there's not a rush. You know, it's one of the things, everybody's all freaked out. What's going to happen? Are we all going to die? Eventually, we are all going to die, yes. Yes, that's true. But I'm not worried. I'm not scared. I'm not part of the... I'm not jumping off cliffs. But today I'm going to talk about Star Trek, and maybe I'll get to some other things. And then tomorrow I'll talk about what's going on in Taiwan. It's really fascinating, quite actually. And then I think after that I might get into some of the other issues that are going on. Some issues in Taiwan's culture, and the return of feudalism. Star Trek Discovery. No, the Taiwan Special. I've been in Taiwan. What do I think about these things? I was in Taiwan when I watched the first Star Trek reboot movie. It's Star Trek. It was called Star Trek. And they had Leonard Nimoy in it. Into Darkness, Star Trek Into Darkness was the next one. It was kind of a Spock Kirk origin story. And they had the Kobayashi Maru. With Kirk, which was mentioned, part of the Star Trek geekery here, but the Kobayashi Maru was mentioned in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan is a classic, even if you're not into Star Trek. It's a very, very amazing story. It's earned its place in the famous movies, even for non-Star Trek fans. But they talk about the Kobayashi Maru. And so in the Star Trek movie reboot, 10 years ago? 11 years ago, they started with, early on, they had the Kobayashi Maru with Kirk that they talked about in The Wrath of Khan all those years earlier with William Shatner. Okay. Well, no, it was a no-win scenario. And Captain James Kirk never believed in no-win scenarios. So when he was being tested at the Academy, his solution was to hack into the school servers and make the no-win scenario test winnable, and that was how he defeated it, because he doesn't believe in no-win scenarios. He believes it. He doesn't believe that a no-win scenario tests anything, because he believes that was one of the things about Star Trek. Captain Kirk always believed that there was a way forward. Gene Roddenberry, I don't think he believed in God at all. There were a lot of problems in his thinking, but he did believe that the future was going to be good. And a lot of people, they looked at Star Trek as hope and future that 300 years later, we're still going to be here, and that was an idea that gave them a lot of hope. Now, interestingly, there is some Christian prophecy that we will be traveling to and inhabiting and populating other planets long after Christ's time on Earth, far in the future. That the planets have a curse on them or something, and that Christians will go there and pray and do miracles, and suddenly almost every planet will become a Class M planet to live on. Maybe we'll even be able to colonize Mercury as a beautiful ocean waving paradise. It's entirely possible. That there's prophecy, Christian prophecy about this. Not Bible prophecy, Christian prophecy. So I don't want to dive into that too much, but I'm not sure if you know what Christian prophecy. That's another day for another discussion. Star Trek Discovery. I watched the Taiwanese try to see what Star Trek was. And it was kind of an introduction to the Taiwanese as far as Star Trek goes. And they don't really know that much about Star Trek. Star Trek. I think Star Trek Discovery was the best Star Trek ever. I know that's going to make some people upset. I didn't like what they did with the Klingon. They changed the Klingon. Look, if you're not a Star Trek fan, at least, listen to this, because I'm going to talk about movies. Okay, I'm not going to do Star Trek geekery much more than I have. The Klingons were these alien warrior race, and they changed the makeup and the prosthetics and stuff for Star Trek Discovery. And that bothered a lot of Star Trek fans. And then they tried to work it in because, Klingons have had different looks through the different series. When the Klingons first appeared long ago in the William Shatner series, the first time Klingons showed up, they didn't have any bumps on their forehead. And then shortly after that in the series, they had this little tiny little row of ridges on their forehead. And they, a lot of them kept that into the Star Trek movies with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. When we had Star Trek The Next Generation, they had this great big bumpy thing of silly putty or whatever on their foreheads with Worf and the others. And so that kind of was a new Klingon forehead. So the prosthetics changed. That was a third one. And later on in Deep Space Nine, it was another Star Trek series, Worf from The Next Generation went back in time to the Captain Kirk Star Trek time and saw the Klingons with no bumps on their foreheads. That was in Trouble with Tribbles, the episode. Adorable episode. If you're not a Star Trek fan, you've got to watch Trouble with Tribbles. It was a classic from the TV series. Very hilarious. My mother wasn't a big Star Trek fan, but she loved Trouble with Tribbles. And Worf says, they are Klingons, but we do not talk about it with outsiders. And so the argument was that there are different types of Klingons on the Klingon planet, and that these Klingons with the new other different no lead other than weird foreheads in Star Trek Discovery were yet another segment of the Klingon population. I'm not sure that I like that, but okay. It didn't seem to totally fit with the story. The other thing was they changed the special effects of warp speed, that the stars were wiggling in fat in the first season of Star Trek Discovery, and then they straightened out to be these blurs in the second one, but they never looked like the warp speed of all the other TV series, Voyager, The Next Generation, and Deep Space Nine, and even Star Trek Enterprise, the other four main TV series. So, and the movies, for that matter, the four movies with Patrick Stewart. So, why did they change warp speed? They were changing special effects, is my point. Sorry for the babble, but they were changing the special effects. Other than that, Star Trek Discovery was the best Star Trek I've ever seen. It was compelling, it was glued together, and it really was Star Trek. It was real Star Trek. And I'm going to talk about plot elements. You know, plot elements are important. They're vital. Star Trek, what makes it true Star Trek? Star Trek is an overblown science fiction imagination. It's a science fiction with a wild imagination. It's what drives the plot. The plot is driven by an overly imaginative science fiction, interplanetary diplomacy or relations, and a strict adherence to loosely interpreted rules. Okay. They've got a lot of cowboy, you know, rodeo, high noon showdown type of moments. At the end, they usually have a big surprise that saves the day. It's going to be a total turn of events. And you're like, oh, I should have seen that coming. And that's not like in every movie, but they really make sure they do that in Star Trek. There's a massive surprise that was coming the whole time. They do that. And then there's always kinky romance, you know, alien relations or whatever. And, you know, like an alien female accidentally gets a human man pregnant who didn't know that it was a mating ritual. You know, like, always weird, kinky romance. And I mean, think about, I always said that Star Trek is a sex cult. I've jokingly said that the whole plot makes sense if you interpret it as a sex cult. And then the bridge crew, is like a family. And they did it. And the plot is driven by interpersonal conflict, and science. You've got this science fiction problem and interpersonal conflict and the presence of kinky romance and an interplanetary, maybe interstellar, but always, sometimes there were, it's arguments between planets in the same solar system. That's what the Wrath of Khan was based on. Which planet are we on? So you got an interplanetary conflict And you always save the day with some combination of interpersonal relationships and solving some science fiction problem. Wrath of Khan. Spock died to fix some science fiction thing that isn't real. But in doing so, Kirk lost his friend. And he did it because he's a friend. You know, so you got interpersonal stuff and mixed with science. And it's a really interesting thing. It's a very well-woven plot thing that they use in Star Trek. And they did that and executed it in Star Trek Discovery. And when I talk about interpersonal conflict, you know, there are these interpersonal relationships that are deep, very deep. Star Trek V, Spock meets his brother. And that's there's a brother thing. So Spock doesn't kill the bad guy early on, and then that's what launches the whole rest of the story. You've always got to go back and get reconciled or wrestle with the old demons or clean out the skeletons in the closet with some old relationship in order to, you know, you've got, you know, the planet A is going to, you know, the intergalactians are going to commit genocide against the Martians, unless the lieutenant, travels back in time to reconcile things with his estranged mother-in-law. In order to get the whatchamacallit working, you know, it's always something like that. And it's fascinating and it's interesting. And the thing about science fiction is that you don't have to worry about factual inconsistencies because you can create your own world. You can't get a bridge in the wrong place. You can't get a law that's wrong in this country or that state because you've invented them all anyway. Whatever is right is what you create in your science fiction world. So that's the beauty of science fiction. It you have to be consistent only with yourself. You don't have to be a walking encyclopedia of history to get every single squirrel properly located on every single tree in the entire timeline of Earth. When you do realistic fiction or legal thrillers, like criminal law thrillers, or, you know, Sherlock Holmes, a mystery thriller, you've got to have a lot of stuff in order. You have to have a lot of facts right, or it's not believable. So, you know, by those standards, Star Trek Discovery did it, and they really were awesome. I thought that the character Michael got a little bit preachy about halfway through season two, but they toned it back. Other than that, I tell you what, that was just fascinating. No, I recently saw Star Trek Discovery, recently watched it, and I'm thrilled with it. The other thing, you know, this has been fun talking about plots, but I've been looking into this series. What was it? Prison Break is on Netflix. Pardon me. I'm only into the first few episodes, but I'm already kind of not impressed with Prison Break. The warden, it's like at some points he's really tough and then other times he's a pushover, and it does serve to push the plot forward, but it's as if the warden is supposed to be three different people. He's a counselor to the guy who's going to die, tell him to bring in his family, reconcile with his family. And then he's the super tough guy to look after and to keep everybody in line and punish people, but also to kind of sort of give some favor justice towards our hero of the story. But then other times he's a complete pushover who lets this guy get what he wants. And it's just not consistent. They could have had him do all those things, but in a way that was consistent with his character. And they're conflating traits that should be other characters, three different characters, and they should, you know, be all... they should at least reconcile them or change how he says things, and then it'd be believable. That'd be fine. But see, this is something that happens in a story, in story writing theory. You can search Dramatica. No, I know about this. I've got a million words on Amazon, and it isn't for no reason. I've done research on how to write stories and stuff, and I am planning on writing my own series. But I don't want to do a bad job, so I'm absorbing myself with other stories in the meanwhile. And one of the things they do in writing a story is you have these decision points. Someone's got to make an important decision, and someone else somewhere, maybe same person, needs to summarize what the decision is that's at stake. Because you might not be following all the science or all the factors, or all the things going on. So someone explains the long version, and someone else explains it super simple so that the idiots watching the movie or reading the story can follow along. I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, You know, it's storyline for dummies. You know, you've got the complex thing to keep the super smart people occupied, and then you've got the dummy line for the dummies watching the movie, so they all can kind of follow along with something happening. So, yeah, there's 8,000 things they have to fix. What? I only see a big tower that needs to blow up, you know, and everybody's interested in the movie. So they've always got the complex version, then they've got the simple explanation. But then when it comes decision point, they're supposed to have someone that argues. It doesn't matter who they teach. It doesn't matter who. It doesn't matter what. You got to make a decision. Someone's got to argue with them about it. So as you may recall in Avengers, remember when Hawkeye and Black Widow go to get the Soul Stone and they have this big argument and fight about who's going to, you know, right. Okay. That's a conflict. That's now you're supposed to think, what? That just makes a story make sense. Yeah. Because you're supposed to have an argument before making an important decision so that you understand how important it is. That was a very good example of having an argument in order to make an important decision, to take an important action that's central to the plot. That was a very good example in Avengers. But a lot of the time, in the original Star Trek series, with DeForest Kelly and William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and those guys, in the original one, they would have characters flip-flop their own opinions in those arguments at critical decisions. And in Prison Break, I see a lot of arguments being brought up, but not necessarily by the right people or at the right time. So I've always said, you know, you've got to have these arguments in order for the plot to move forward, so you know, okay, someone's doing something important. We know it's important because they just had a little argument about it. Wait, are you sure? Are you sure you want to do this? You know, that's theatrics and drama. I agree. You got to have the argument before the important action. But the argument needs to be consistent with the characters who are arguing. And that's usually not in a lot of movies. And so while they've got the warden of Prison Break arguing with people at different times, it moves the plot forward. This guy goes there, that guy goes here. Now we have a problem it has to solve. It's the plot. But the warden is not consistent with his character. They call him the Pope in the movie, but or in the TV series. So Prison Break, you know, one of the issue with Prison Break, like for example, they don't do conjugal visits in Illinois. I went and looked it up, of course. Yes, of course I did. You know, that's a factual inconsistency. And so, you know, there's this visitation stuff with people being surprised at the prison that someone showed up. Usually those things are by appointment and you know it in advance. And if you can't show up for an appointment, then you know, there's some communication that goes on with those things. Yes, I know. I understand how this works. I'm not a total fool when it comes to CJ. All right, well, That was my analysis of movies and plots, and I hope there wasn't too much Star Trek for the non-Trekkers, or, well, they're Trekkies, but I think we like to call ourselves Trekkers. See you tomorrow.